ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
G'day, welcome to The World Today. It's Thursday the 18th of December. I'm Nick Grimm, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Today, a 10-year-old girl among those laid to rest at funerals for the Bondi shooting victims, and calls for a royal commission into anti-Semitism as the federal government warns an inquiry would get in the way of urgent action needed now.
Think about the Disability Royal Commission or the Aged Care Royal Commission or the Veteran Suicide Royal Commission. While those royal commissions were running for years and years, it was often said, oh, we need to wait to see what the royal commission said. Well, that's not what's needed right now. What's needed right now is more action.
But first, as Australia's Jewish community and other mourners continue to lay to rest the victims of Sydney's terror attack, Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has announced a raft of measures to combat anti-Semitism based on recommendations from Special Envoy Gillian Siegel. They include a crackdown on hate speech and on those found to be promoting violence. Under the proposal, new powers will also be given to the Home Affairs Minister to cancel and reject visas. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese made the announcement from Canberra.
It was an attack on our Jewish community, but it was also an attack on the Australian way of life. Australians are shocked and angry. I am angry. It is clear we need to do more to combat this evil scourge, much more. There is no place in Australia for anti-Semitism. It is an evil that tears at the fabric of our country. It puts the peaceful, free and equal society that we cherish at risk.
Meanwhile, the surviving alleged gunman from Sunday's terror attack in Bondi has now been formally charged by police as his 15 victims continue to be laid to rest. In other developments, the crime scene at Bondi Beach has now been reopened to the public after Sunday's terrorist attack. The memorial outside the Bondi Pavilion, adjacent to the scene of the shootings, has also been growing day by day, and survivors are now beginning to share their stories. Our reporter Tanya Dendrinos is at the memorial site in Bondi and joins me now. Tanya, one of the 40 survivors, has this morning addressed the media with an impassioned plea. What did he have to say?
Nick, Arsen Ostrovsky is an international human rights lawyer. He addressed the media here in front of the memorial at Bondi. He was injured in Sunday's terror attack, and our listeners might have seen footage of him after he suffered a head injury. His opening words today were, "I am a survivor," but he says they are words he never thought he'd have to say. Arsen Ostrovsky says he actually grew up here in Bondi, but he's been living in Israel for more than a decade. Tragically, he and his family moved back here only a few weeks ago. He said that his daughters have already seen absolute horror, and unfortunately, he's now been caught up in this very tragedy. He's actually moved back here to Australia to take up a role as the incoming head of the Sydney office of the Australia, Israel and Jewish Affairs Council, a role he says was specifically to help this nation tackle a rise in anti-Semitism. He says there were many signs in the lead up to the terror attack on Sunday that have been ignored, and that the government now needs to step up and take ownership.
This has to be a transformational watershed moment. We have to come together. We have to recognise that even though this was an attack on Jews, it was an attack on Australia, on our society, on our social fabric and our way of life as a whole. If we do not learn from this, if we do not come together from this, if we do not take the appropriate steps, if our leaders do not show real, serious, tangible, immediate leadership, then hatred will fester. And catastrophes like this can repeat itself. So we don't have a choice. We have to learn from this. We have to come back and we have to grow and strengthen as a community.
Attack survivor Arsen Ostrovsky and one of the gunmen allegedly behind the terror attack, Tanya, has now been charged by police. Can you run us through the charges?
Nick, those charges against the surviving gunman Naveed Akram were laid late yesterday. The 24-year-old alleged murderer awoke from a coma on Tuesday and attended his first court hearing via video link from his hospital bed. He remains there under police guard. Naveed Akram has been formally charged with 59 offences over the terror attack. They include 15 counts of murder and 40 counts of wounding with intent to murder. He was also charged with committing a terrorist act. Naveed Akram made no application for bail and it was formally refused, with his case scheduled to be mentioned again in court next week. As for the second shooter, his father, Sajid Akram, he was shot dead by police at the scene on Sunday.
Our reporter Tanya Dendrinos at Bondi Beach. Well, for the latest on the funerals underway for the victims of the attack, let's go to our reporter Alison Shaw. She's been at the services in the eastern suburbs. Alison, the funeral of 10-year-old Matilda is getting underway there. There'll be a lot of very difficult emotions, of course, for those attending the service.
Absolutely, Nick. It is a very difficult day for the family here and the tight-knit Sydney Jewish community after what's been a very long and painful week. Matilda is being remembered as a kind, joyful child. She was the youngest victim in Sunday night's terror attack in Bondi, and people here at the funeral have brought bright yellow balloons to celebrate her spirit. Others have also walked in carrying bouquets of flowers. Yesterday, her school wrote in a statement that Matilda was a little ray of sunshine who brightened everyone's day with her radiant smile and infectious laugh. Matilda and her family were attending the Hanukkah event at Bondi Beach on Sunday, and before the shooting, her family says she was playing with the animals at the petting zoo and had her face painted and was enjoying the traditional Jewish donuts being handed out too. But today, her family is here in Sydney's East. But earlier this week, her grieving parents did speak out. Her mother said that she couldn't imagine what sort of person could pull the trigger on a little girl who was running for her father. And her dad said that the family had moved here from Ukraine and named their daughter Matilda because it was the most Australian name they could think of. He also asked people to remember her name. Earlier this morning at Bondi Pavilion, there was a poster of her hanging on the gates and also another one on the wall with her name and a picture of a cartoon bumblebee, which represents her middle name. And in one of the floral tributes, I noticed someone had written, "Precious Matilda B, forever in our hearts." Her dad said her middle name was B and asked people to just draw a little B and post it somewhere. And here at the funeral, a volunteer has been giving out stickers with her name and a picture of a little bumblebee as well, as a symbol for this bright, happy girl who was killed in Sunday's attack.
And Alison, of course, Matilda isn't the only victim being farewelled today. What can you tell us about the other funerals that are underway?
That's right, Nick. Earlier this morning at the same venue here in Sydney's East, mourners farewelled 87-year-old Alexander Clateman. He was a Holocaust survivor, and his wife Larissa said that her husband of 57 years had died shielding her from the bullets at the Hanukkah event on Bondi Beach, which they had attended with their grandchildren. So in addition to his wife, Alexander Clateman leaves behind two children and 11 grandchildren. Earlier this morning, I saw dozens of mourners entering the funeral home, some in tears, others embracing each other. The New South Wales Premier Chris Minns also attended that funeral this morning. And after the service, some mourners walked behind the hearse as it slowly drove away. And later this afternoon, members of the Sydney Jewish community and family members will also be gathering for the funeral for 78-year-old Tibor Whitesen. He was a father, grandfather and great-grandfather who migrated to Australia from Israel in 1988, and his family described him as full of life, his granddaughter saying he was truly the best grandfather you could ask for. She said he was so proud of us and loved us more than life itself. He only saw the best in people and will be dearly missed. So there is a lot of deep sorrow in the Sydney Jewish community as they continue to grieve those who were killed in Sunday's terrorist attack, and more funerals are expected to be held in the coming days.
Alison Shaw, our reporter there. Now to demands for a royal commission to be established into the causes of the Bondi attack and how it might have been prevented. Former Coalition Treasurer Josh Frydenberg is leading the call for an inquiry as he continues to level blame for the attack directly at Prime Minister Albanese. But the federal government is pushing back, as Stephanie Smale reports.
The former coalition treasurer Josh Frydenberg isn't letting up on the Prime Minister Anthony Albanese.
Australia's been radicalised on his watch in the last 2.5 years.
He's urging the federal government, particularly Home Affairs Minister Tony Burke, to establish a royal commission to find answers about the Bondi attack.
I don't know what he's got to hide from a royal commission. He wanted one into banks, he wanted one into aged care, he wanted one into the welfare system. We've had the deadliest terrorist attack in Australia's history, and there are so many unanswered questions. Why was there 3 police protecting 1,000 people?
Tony Burke says a royal commission would divert resources away from the investigation into the tragedy. The Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, agrees it's not the right move.
We want our agencies 100% focused on the investigations, and we don't want them delayed or deterred by a royal commission. You know, everyone's focus, including the agencies involved here, needs to be on the investigation, needs to be on getting to the bottom of what happened here.
We have had royal commissions about much more trivial matters than this, and I think it is the bare minimum we should expect from the government.
Liberal Senator James Patterson is calling the federal government's resistance a disgrace. He argues authorities and governments can act and participate in an inquiry at the same time.
Only a royal commission can identify whether or not operational failures occurred here. A royal commissioner has the powers to get behind and look at the intelligence and policing issues. There may well have been no operational failures, but we won't know until we get to the bottom of that. And there may well have been policy failures as well.
The New South Wales government is recalling state parliament before Christmas to consider gun reforms and legislation that would ban inflammatory protests during terrorism investigations as part of its crackdown on anti-Semitism. And overseas, British police are vowing to take tougher action against demonstrators using placards and chants to target the Jewish community too. Prominent Jewish Labor MP and former Attorney General Mark Dreyfus says hate speech and protest rules do need to be revisited.
We need to review those hate speech laws to make sure that the settings are right. We need to have another look at protest laws. This is largely a state legislative matter, but there's some things that the federal government can do to see whether the settings are right there. We need to work on education in schools. And yes, there are some things that we can do on gun control.
But he argues a royal commission isn't the answer for now.
I'm not saying never to a royal commission, but I do know, having observed in recent years some very, very long-running royal commissions that really served the main purpose they served was to put off action, because people would say, oh, we're waiting. Think about the Disability Royal Commission or the Aged Care Royal Commission or the Veteran Suicide Royal Commission. While those royal commissions were running for years and years, it was often said, oh, we need to wait to see what the royal commission said. Well, that's not what's needed right now. What's needed right now is more action.
Others argue any new laws must be strictly enforced to make change. Dennis Richardson is a former ASIO intelligence agency boss and former Secretary of Defence and Foreign Affairs.
It's fine to talk about revisiting hate speech, but legislation in relation to hate speech is totally irrelevant unless it's enforced.
He argues the dangers some Jewish Australians are facing are unacceptable.
Some children in this country can't go to school without their schools being under armed guard, and their childcare centres must be under armed guard. That is unacceptable, and that is a failure across the community.
But he says personal attacks among politicians won't help the community rebuild.
At a moment like this, you overwhelmingly want a bipartisanship. I think the community overwhelmingly looks to its political leaders to come together. Obviously, there's a lot of anger around at the moment.
Former Chief of ASIO Dennis Richardson ending that report by Stephanie Smale. Thanks for listening to The World Today here on ABC Radio across Australia and on the Listen app. You can subscribe, remember, to the podcast for all our stories. Just search for The World Today. Hopes of a bipartisan political approach to the Bondi shootings crumbled this week as the federal opposition criticised the government's focus on toughening gun laws and echoed concerns in the community that it's been too slow to act on anti-Semitism. The opposition is supporting calls from members of the Jewish community for the Albanese government to implement the full recommendations delivered by Special Envoy on Anti-Semitism, Gillian Segal. As we heard earlier, the Prime Minister says he fully supports the report and will continue to work through the implementation of its 13 recommendations. So let's take a closer look at those recommendations now and the concerns that have been raised about what they could mean for the wider community. Matteo Vegani is director of the Tackling Hate Lab at Deakin University. We spoke ahead of the government's announcement. Matteo Vegani, from your perspective, how effective would be the report's recommendations in helping ensure we never see a repeat of the violence like we saw on Sunday?
Some of the recommendations were constructive. So in particular, the ones about collecting data about anti-Semitic hate crimes and incidents, or having a stronger coordination between police forces, are really important. Many of the recommendations included in the plan would be effective for diminishing negative attitudes towards the Jewish population in Australia. So, for example, the ones about rebuilding trust and social cohesion and reviving the interfaith work that has actually stalled in recent years. They are important recommendations, but they are not going to matter when it comes to terrorist attacks. For terrorist attacks, you need really to do the countering violent extremism work and counterterrorism work that Australian law enforcement agencies and communities have been working on for years. So, for example, working with communities to detect early signs of risk and better and stronger legislation framework to combat terrorism and to limit access to firearms.
But concerns have also been identified with how the report recommends tackling anti-Semitism. What are the concerns?
There are concerns in relation to the more punitive, let's say, recommendations in Segal's plan. So, for example, withdrawing funding or imposing penalties on media, cultural, artistic institutions, universities that did not comply with the anti-Semitism standards. So these measures, of course, at the time inflamed the debate and shifted actually the attention away from anti-Semitism to issues about free speech and drawing the line between legitimate criticism of Israel versus anti-Semitism, institutional autonomy. So clearly, with this type of recommendations, you tend to divide the community instead of uniting it.
So what was viewed as problematic about how the report defined what constitutes anti-Semitism?
The main problem in that definition is that some see the definition as conflating between criticism of Israel and anti-Semitism, while others say, no, it's not true. It's actually the way in which the criticism is expressed, because if it's expressed in ways that blame, for example, the whole Jewish population for the actions of Israel, well, that is the anti-Semitism. It's not about criticizing Netanyahu. So it's a complex discussion, but it's very important to address these concerns, and the plan did not do it.
Let's look at some of the criticism. Amnesty International, for example, warned some of the recommendations propose sweeping, vague, and repressive measures that threaten freedom of expression. It would risk deepening community divisions. The Australian Human Rights Commission acknowledged concerns about the implications of the recommendations too.
Absolutely, but again, some of the recommendations. So it is really important to say that we have to look into what the envoy has proposed and go one by one through all the recommendations, and some are really important. We cannot just reject the plan because it doesn't come as a whole. Right. We have to be able to look into it and see what is useful and what needs more discussion. And I think these criticisms make sense because in the plan, it is not addressed and explained how we can distinguish between legitimate criticism of Israel versus anti-Semitism. Because if it was clear and if everyone would agree on it, well, those recommendations wouldn't be controversial. So that is the sticking point.
Do you worry that a rushed response could have the adverse effect of heightening tensions in the community?
Well, again, I think the plan, for example, addresses mostly anti-Semitism as a sentiment, as a public sentiment in the population. That is not necessarily associated. Actually, most of the times, it is not associated with the action of self-radicalized or even recruited individuals who commit terrorist acts in the name of global terrorist organizations like ISIS. Now, the investigations are still ongoing, so we don't know exactly the relationship between the two attackers and a chain of command and control of ISIS. But what we know is that clearly these people were not influenced or did not act because of the public sentiment. So I guess we have to distinguish between these two types of problems. And if we want to talk about how to prevent attacks like the one we have seen in Bondi, we need to focus on counter-extremism and counter-terrorism work. If we want to talk about reducing anti-Semitic sentiment among the Australian population, then we can talk about the envoy's proposals and recommendations.
Matteo Vergani, thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you very much.
And Associate Professor Matteo Vergani is Director of the Tackling Hate Lab at Deakin University. Police in the Philippines are investigating the movements of the alleged Bondi Beach gunman in the weeks leading up to the mass shooting. Immigration officials confirmed this week the father and son were in the Philippines for almost the entire month of November. The region they visited is regarded as a hotbed for Islamic militants, with authorities trying to work out whether the pair had contact with any local extremist groups or undertook training of any kind. Bridget Fitzgerald reports.
The Bondi gunmen spent close to 4 weeks in the Philippines before they carried out their attack, and authorities want to know why. Catherine Delaray is a major with the Philippines National Police.
Did they stay here? And if they did stay here, have they met any other personalities? Where did they stay? How many days?
Sajid Akram and Naveed Akram arrived in Davao, the largest city on the southern island of Mindanao, on the 1st of November. They then returned to Sydney via Manila on November 28, just weeks before the Bondi attack. The Mindanao region has been a hotbed for Islamic militants since the 1990s. Filipino police say they're working with other agencies to determine where they may have stayed and who they may have met. Dr. Josh Roos is a political sociologist at Deakin University and an expert in extremism.
There are a lot of Australians visit the Philippines, and a father-son visiting alone wouldn't raise any flags. However, it's the history and the track record of the son, who had been listed on the ASIO agenda as recently as 2019. And so there's a question about what are the processes that are in place. Identifying potential terrorists is literally like finding a needle in a haystack. There's a lot of extremism and a lot of polarised statements. The critical element is finding, you know, something that links them to a potential act of planning. That's very tough, but obviously something needs to be done to really stamp down.
Naveed Akram was investigated by Australia's security agency, ASIO, 6 years ago for about 6 months, but he was assessed as posing no ongoing threat. There were two homemade Islamic State flags found in and around the attacker's vehicle, alongside improvised explosive devices, and the Bondi attack has been designated as a terrorist incident. The ABC understands the father and son are suspected to have had military-style training in the Philippines. But the Filipino government says the Philippines isn't an ISIS training hotspot. Claire Castro is the presidential press secretary.
Currently, there is no validated report or confirmation that the individuals involved in the Bondi Beach incident received any form of training in the Philippines. Philippine authorities, in coordination with international partners, continue to verify all available information, but no evidence has been presented to support claims that the country was used for terrorist training.
Local media in the Philippines are reporting the Bondi terror suspects appear to have rarely left their hotel room. Georgi Engelbrecht is a senior analyst for the International Crisis Group based in the Philippines. He says while Islamic State is diminished, there are still active groups in the Mindanao region, but that it'll be the job of authorities to determine whether the father and son met with local groups or perhaps attempted to and failed.
It may have been also a bit of a red herring, essentially, if they really just stayed in Davao. Was there any impact on what then happened in Australia? It doesn't look like that. But of course, it is too early to say. Maybe there's some other pieces of information that would need to gather.
Rohan Gunaratan is a professor of security studies at the Nanyang Technological University in Singapore and an expert in Islamic State. He says the continued influence of IS around the world demonstrates the need to do more to combat extremism, which he says has been evident in some groups carrying out recent protests in Australia.
The real problem is not gun laws. The real problem is exclusivism, extremism, violence, and terrorism. And to fight that, you must stop the suspicion, prejudice, resentment, anger, and hatred that is being generated as a result of these uncontrolled protests and vilification campaigns. Because terrorism is a vicious byproduct of extremism. If you permit ideological extremism, if you permit radical clerics to operate in your country openly, then you are going to have more terrorism.
In a statement, an Australian Federal Police spokesperson said it didn't have any validated information concerning the claims about Sajid and Naveed Akram.
Bridget Fitzgerald. And that's all from the World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Nick Grimm.
Hi, I'm Andy Park with the ABC News Daily Podcast. You know, catastrophe has a way of shaping leaders, whether it's Winston Churchill during World War II, George Bush during 9/11, or Scott Morrison during the Black Summer bushfires. It may define Prime Minister Anthony Albanese's leadership too. Today, the Chief Political Correspondent at The Conversation, Michelle Grattan, on whether Anthony Albanese can rise to the challenge. Look for the ABC News Daily Podcast on the ABC Listen app.